It's 5pm, this is IC Radio. Hello and welcome to Monday the 7th of January 2019 edition of iScience Radio, our first show of the year. I'm so excited to be back in the studio. Anyway, today we'll be talking about the books we read over the holiday, some fascinating research into an old practice of how assistants help surgeons put on their gowns, and when they do so, they're probably transferring their own bacteria, and surgeons should do it on their own. Anyway, we're going to check out whether this really works in the studio, and you can join in at home. So all you need is some rubber gloves and a dressing gown. Seriously. During the first record, just go and get some rubber gloves and a dressing gown, and you too can see how many bacteria you can transfer onto a sterile gown. Anyway, we'll also be talking about new research that shows it's possible to decode speech from recordings of neurons firing. In case you were worried about some random computer hearing your thoughts in the future, we have some research that will let you know if you are normal in the amount of times you think about sex, sleep, and food. And finally, the most popular of all New Year's resolutions, we're going to hear about Veganuary. So I'm Hilary Guyte, your iScience Radio editor. Jason Hoskin will be producing the show with Rachel Nung, and I am joined in the studio today by Madeline, Katie, Bernadetta and Emily. Please join in the show at home by sending a message at icradio.com/contact. That's icradio.com/contact. We really want you to be part of this. So stay with us between now and 6pm right here on IC Radio. The radio show where we talk about science, we have fun with science, and we play some really cool records. This is iScience Radio. But first, as usual, it's time to catch up with the latest science headlines from our news editor, Madeline.
This is iScience Radio News.
Hi everyone, I'm Madeline, news editor at iScience, and this week I'm here to give you an animal-themed news roundup to see in the new year. First up, Berlin's unwanted Christmas trees have ended their days as a festive snack for zoo elephants and stocking fillers for some of their fellow residents. The once-a-year treats arrived last Friday at the Tierpark, one of the German capital's two zoos. The elephants eat the trees themselves, whereas the monkeys are presented with trees decorated with vegetables and the tigers get meat decorations. The latter two can then treat the decorations as a fun and tasty snack. Next, it has been reported that jellyfish numbers are booming worldwide, with the potential to disrupt ocean ecosystems in a flash. The cause of this mayhem is thought to be due to a combination of warmer seas, polluted waters where the hardy jellyfish remains able to breed despite the death of other sea creatures, and overfishing, allowing the creatures to take advantage of disrupted ecosystems. Many scientists don't think the ocean ecosystem can revert back to what it was. What is clear, however, is that we need to take better care of our oceans and work to tackle climate change, pollution, and overfishing. Finally, the rarest bird in the world, a species of duck called the Madagascar pochard, has been given a new home in time for 2019. An international team of researchers released 21 of the birds at a lake in the north of Madagascar. It is a step towards the recovery of a species that just over a decade ago was thought to be extinct. And that's all we've got time for here. Happy New Year, everyone, and don't forget to tune in next week for more science news.
Thanks, Madeline. That was great. Now to start today's show. We're going to be talking about the books we read over the break. And I wouldn't mind if I can just start with mine. I read The Diet Myth, The Real Science Behind What We Eat by Tim Spector. I've been meaning to read this for a little while. So, Madeline, I think you've read it as well.
I have, actually, but I can't remember very much about it. I'm hoping to hear more.
Well, I thought the book was actually less about diet than about our microbiomes. And does everybody know about microbiome?
Yes, a little bit.
Yes.
A little bit. Not a lot. I'm a physicist.
Jason, do you know about microbiomes? No, good. All right. So I'll explain this to Jason because he likes my explanations. We know that.
Is it okay. a thing?
No, this is actually 100 trillion bacteria that live on our skin, in our hair, our mouths, our guts. 4 pounds in weight of bacteria live in our guts alone. This is just, we're just swarming with the things.
So when I weigh myself, I can take off 4 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not your fault.
Easy way to lose weight here.
Yeah. And you know when you get the squits, you kind of lose weight quite quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's you actually clear out most of your microbiome and it has to regrow. If it's really bad.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good way to lose weight.
It's not a good way, but actually it's worth
I'll
knowing.
Skip that.
Anyway, so what Tim Spector did, now I was interested in this because he was at medical school at the same time I was. Uh-huh. So I was like, oh, he's done well for himself. Oh, clever guy. Anyway, so he's got a massive database of identical and non-identical twins, and he's been able to use that to unpick the contribution to weight weight. Our weight from our genes, our microbiome, and our eating habits. Mm-hmm. So it's quite kind of clever science. So he reckons the genes account for about 60 to 70% of the difference in our weight between us. And that these genetic factors aren't just static. So the fact you may have a genetic predisposition to being overweight doesn't necessarily mean you will, because you've got those epigenetic factors that modulate your genes and the expression of them. So something like your microbiome will interact with your genes and turn on or off hunger, or how well you use, how much you're likely to gain weight from a certain amount of calories. And so that's what he thinks means is why we've had this rapid change in obesity. So you don't get genetic change that fast.
Yeah.
So it comes from, anyway. So
is there any way of knowing how our microbiome looked long time ago versus now?
No. But, well, they know he has been tracking it over time, quite a number of years. And what we do know is that people's, the different number of species that you have is less varied. So having a very, very varied microbiome, which comes from eating a bit of dirt, a bit of probiotics, some kind of live bugs that you get from yogurt or kefir or something like that. And then prebiotics, which is the stuff called inulin, which actually your good bugs feed off. So Spector believes that the makeup of our microbiome is the most important determinant of our weight, because the microbiome impacts on how hungry we feel, how much energy we have, how much energy we extract from the food we eat. So that whole idea that calories were, you know, a calorie is a calorie, he says doesn't work anymore.
I remember one really interesting point he made was about the variety of foods that we eat. So in order to populate our microbiome and have a diverse gut bacteria, you need to eat lots of different types of food, which is going against what lots of people do nowadays with dieting, where they restrict to certain food groups. And in doing so, they're actually reducing the size of their microbiome and therefore might actually be ending up putting on weight.
So you can actually, isn't there a case for transplanting microbiome from one person to another?
There is an extreme version.
The fecal transplant.
Fecal transplants, yeah. It's early days. I don't think people...
I think it's just really an attractive thing to do, but it's been there for...
The only thing it's currently licensed for in the UK is for patients with certain gut infections, the main one being Clostridium difficile, where actually the last resort treatment would be a fecal transplant and has been shown to have some efficacy.
So how do they choose who...
So it's patients who aren't responding to the normal treatments for...
But as in, like...
No, but who's poo?
Oh, who's poo?
Who's good poo?
I think you need some healthy...
You get a panel of people and then you're like, looks nice, and you're like, I'll take that one.
I'll have you.
It's the X factor.
Healthy poo. Put through a centrifuge to take out the nasty bacteria.
Yeah. Okay, fine. There was one interesting fact in the book. Well, there was lots and lots of interesting facts in the book. It's nicely written. It's kind of, you know, takes you along. It's sort of like a very long read in The Observer. Yeah, kind of takes you there. But it's lots of information there. And it feels like you can trust the information. It's not sort of overhyped. And quite a lot of the time he says, we really don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we need to stop pretending we know. But this one fact I came across was that, so you're talking about the fecal transplants. So when children are born by cesarean section, mm-hmm. they're not exposed to the bacteria in the mother's vagina or her thighs, but they're coming out in a sterile environment. And so when they get handed to a nurse to be washed, it depends on the microbiome of that nurse, because that's the first bacteria that baby will be coming across. And so some people, and this hasn't been tested through trials yet, have started to actually take swabs from the mother to put on the baby's skin so that they can actually simulate what happens at birth. So apparently what you're exposed to at birth impacts on your long-term weight or your microbiome. I mean, I think other things can change it, but they have shown that identical twins differ depending on who cuddled them first.
Crazy stuff.
Crazy stuff. Okay, sorry. Well, that's my interesting book. Katie, you've been reading something interesting.
Yes, I have. So this was inspired by our last assignment, actually, which we had to do last term. And it's called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. So a bit about the story itself. In 1951, an African-American woman called Henrietta Lacks had cells taken from her cervical tumour without her consent. The cells from her tumour, HeLa cells, became the first human cells to survive outside of the human body and continue to multiply for a long period of time. Sadly, Henrietta passed away later that year. However, her cells are still alive to this day. HeLa cells have enabled medical breakthroughs in almost every field of science, most prominently in helping to test vaccinations for diseases such as polio. And a lot was done around that time and for the following decades about what HeLa has been able to achieve. But the woman behind them was kept under wraps for so long, people thought it was Helen Lane is one example of the names, and Henrietta's name didn't get mentioned for several decades after, and her family didn't know either. So this book doesn't focus on the scientific advancements, but actually explores the woman who the cells originated from through her meetings with the surviving Lacks family, particularly her daughter Deborah. And actually it's a very moving story, because it's about how they've been mistreated by science for so long. And then Rebecca Skloot, the science journalist, came and explained to them the science, which made them more at peace with it. And the fact that their mother's story was actually being told was something that they hadn't heard of before. They just wanted to know about what scientific advancements had been able to make. So, I mean, it brings so many issues to the forefront, such as race, gender, class, especially with regards to sharing the science. And I think it's everyone should read the book.
The extent to which the HeK cells, that's the cells that were taken from Henrietta, are used in the lab cannot be underestimated. Like, anyone who actually works in a biology lab has probably touched those cells, and I mean, they have just been spread throughout the world.
They tried to like quantify it a bit. If you go on Wikipedia, it will give you more accurate figures, but it's something like so many thousands and thousands of research papers actually use HeLa cells.
Literally millions.
Patents involving HeLa cells was sort of like 11,000 or something like that, and several Nobel Prizes have been won with her cells. The extent to it is incredible. The woman behind them wasn't explored until Rebecca Skloot.
Did she actually know that her cells were taken for this purpose of making them immortal, or no?
No. Short answer. this brings in the idea of informed consent, and actually her story brought about lots of changes to do with the consent process.
Mm-hmm. And has the family been given any compensation?
No, so the monetary value is also kind of contested. So the person who cultured it, so George Guy from John Hopkins Hospital, he didn't actually sell it for profit initially. He gave it out as a philanthropic gesture, because they were trying to help for the vaccine for polio at the time. A whole biotechnology has, you know, emerged from it, with people selling it on now for money. But the original people didn't benefit from it. Johns Hopkins Hospital and George Guy didn't. And so they kind of, it's hard to know how you would then track back the money to the original place to give it to them. So no, they haven't been compensated for. But hopefully this book, the film, I'm sure Rebecca Skloot from
That's a fantastic, such an interesting story. Isn't, sorry, did you want to make
those
one
cells
last
are
point?
Probably, because they are cancerous cells, they probably now, compared to what was originally Henrietta's cell, are so different that you couldn't even tell, say that they are Henrietta's cells.
Differentiating the person from the cells, I mean, it's a big issue, and it's bigger than we can talk about now, but... That is also the point.
Well, maybe there's a themed programme later on in term on the cell.
Maybe.
Anyway, so we're hopefully lots of our listeners have stayed online and are joining us now, and we will be sending out the whole programme later. So, Madeline, what have you been reading?
Yeah, well, I'll keep this one brief because I actually haven't started reading it yet. It's more of a book recommendation. It's called The Baby in the Mirror by Charles Fernyhough. And he's a developmental psychologist who took the first 3 years of his daughter's life off work to look after her and also write a beautiful book from the point of view of a father and a developmental psychologist. So I've been told that it intertwines the story of parenthood with that of the first 3 years of a child's life from a psychologist's point of view. So watch this space. Maybe I'll put a book review up on the iScience website.
Oh, that's right. So tell me where the iScience website has book reviews and exhibition reviews as
well.
They'll
be coming soon,
it?
This term, absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Everything at iScienceMagazine.com, isn't it? iSciencemag.com, worth checking out. Emily.
Yes, so I've been reading a book called Other Minds, The Octopus and the Evolution of Intelligent Life by Peter Godfrey Smith. I have just started it, I haven't finished it, so maybe later on there'll be a whole book review on the website. But
Science Mag?
Yeah, but so far it's been really interesting. It kind of focuses on the evolution of octopuses, which is a plural, it's not octopi. That's a fun fact.
Mm-hmm.
And how they have become so intelligent. Because they kind of live very different lives to us. They kind of live solitary lives. And so they've developed on a slightly different path of evolution than humans, whose evolution is linked to social groups and stuff. And as the author has worded it, it is an independent experiment in the evolution of large brains and complex behaviour. Basically, the book is saying that evolution has built minds twice in humans and also in octopuses, and we're completely different to them. And also, as I was reading it, it reminded me of the iScience Earth magazine, because Aoife wrote about alien life and how it might... There's a theory that aliens may have landed on Earth and kind of developed octopuses. Did you guys
read
that one?
Yeah, it was fascinating. Yeah, when you were talking, I thought, I've heard about this. And that was it. Yeah, iScience magazine.
Yeah, so this book is kind of similar to that. It's really interesting. Would anyone like some octopus facts?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
So the octopus nervous system contains 500 million neurons, and it is spread throughout their body, not just their brain. Their arms can act as agents on their own, and they can sense taste and not just touch.
Wow.
Weird.
Which is very weird. Apparently they might have all the other senses in their arms.
So it's like their arms might be like tongues.
Ooh, yes.
your tongue can taste and touch.
Yeah. And there's some theories that they might be able to see out of their tentacles as well, which is very strange indeed.
Wow.
But I think that's why it's so interesting. It's because they're such a different type of life to us that it's kind of hard to imagine how they've developed. So this book kind of takes you through the journey of them.
I've got a question. It might not be fair. You might not know the answer. But is the brain... Why? Well, I suppose it is different because it's kind of spread out, but is it networked differently to ours?
Yes, so it doesn't really have a central brain in terms of like how humans kind of have the brain in the head and then the rest of the nervous system. So it's kind of more evenly spread out, and they're not exactly sure how it kind of links to the centered bit. But yeah.
Did any of you read that article earlier this year about when they gave MDMA to octopuses?
Yes.
It's fantastic.
Amazing.
What happened?
They started exposing parts of their body they don't normally expose, and they're floating around, floating around the tank, and then fondling the water bubbler, which I thought was hilarious.
But I mean, that's so interesting. You hear stories about them escaping tanks to go and eat fish in the other side of the aquarium, and then getting back in.
I was quite interested about how their brains work, because I saw it on Blue Planet, wasn't it? The octopus that actually pretended to hide.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So they hide. They can squeeze into holes the size. I think they have one hard part of their body, and all the rest of the body can squeeze into, you know, a space that small, so they can escape, like,
There's a famous video of octopus in a jar, how it's inside the jar, and then it opens up a jar, and it's a tiny jar, but the octopus is huge, and it squeezes in, and it manages to go out from the jar from the inside. It's really cool.
Katie, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that my my only memory of octopuses is Hank from Finding Dory.
Fantastic.
Great film. Yeah. Great character.
See, he's quite cheeky. He escapes.
That's when you said that. Yeah. I was thinking, that's exactly what happened with Hank in Finding Dory.
Yeah, so it's accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So has anyone eaten octopus?
I actually haven't, no.
I think I probably have.
Well, I'm due Veganuary, so I won't be this month.
Just me then.
Yeah. Well, I'm going out tonight. I sometimes eat fish, so I don't eat meat, but I might not.
Maybe don't. I think. Maybe say that they don't want to put you off really a lot, but they say they're about as intelligent as dogs or 3-year-old children. So.
Gosh. All right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Fine. Anyway, so should we move on now? Bernadetta, you've been reading about bad blood.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a kind of investigative journalism piece, and it's I picked it up because I saw it on essentially on all of the lists of the best books by people like Bill Gates and Obama and the like. And it's a book about Theranos. Has anyone heard about the thing called Theranos?
No.
Which is kind of surprising, because it was a Silicon Valley company that was built up, founded by Elizabeth Holmes, who became the first self-made billionaire woman, and she was probably, when she became a billionaire, 20-something, really early on. And the idea of Theranos was that they patented a technology that allowed them to make hundreds of different tests from a single drop of blood. And it all turned out to be a hoax. So they attracted lots of funders, people like James Mattis, Kissinger, like the elite American sort of army people. And it all turned out to be a hoax, because they never actually created anything that could do these tests, and they just have taken all that money. And Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of this company, is a really interesting character, which is, I think, what drives the whole story in the book. It's really a book that you can't put down, even though it's just a story about how a Silicon Valley company works. It's really worth a read. I would highly recommend people doing it. And it's all about these sort of intrigues and how she managed, even though she never had anything to show for all these people who are funding her, how she managed to convince them to fund her.
Wow, that sounds so intriguing. For all those who have made a New Year's resolution to read more, we hope we've been giving you some inspiration here. So many different types of books to read. And now we have a link to a record, which is called Bad Blood by Taylor Swift. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, now we got problems. And I don't think we can solve them. You made a really deep cut. And baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, did you have to do this? I was thinking that you could be trusted. Did you have to ruin what was shining? Now it's all rusted. Did you have to hit me where I'm weak? Baby, I couldn't breathe. And rub it in so deep. Salt in the wound, like you're laughing right at me. Oh, it's so sad.
these things will catch up to you, and time can heal, but this won't. So if you're coming my way, just don't. Oh, it's so sad to think about the good times, you and I. Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey! Now we got problems, and I don't think we can solve them. You made a really deep cut, and baby, now we got bad blood. Hey! Band-aids don't fix bullet holes. You say sorry just for show. If you live like that, you live with ghosts. Band-aids don't fix bullet holes. You say sorry just for show. If you live like that, you live with ghosts. If you love like that,
that was Bad Blood by Taylor Swift. Moving on to a piece of research that myself and Madeline have been reading, which is about it's about bugs, basically, and it could actually save quite a lot of lives. I love this sort of research. It takes a look at something that just happens regularly. So in America, what they tend to do when a surgeon gowns up and puts on his sterile gown, someone does it for them. And so this study, published in the Journal of Orthopaedic Trauma, looked at the method by which the surgeons were doing that and tried to work out whether it was better for them to do it themselves. And the way they did it, they used resin and ultraviolet light, and so they could see where there was contamination. And by the two-person technique, there was a 67% contamination rate, mostly from the sleeves onto the sleeves of the surgeon's gowns. And if the surgeon was taller, the assistant would end up catching part of their arms onto the surgeon. And it suggests that if a surgeon was to apply his or her own gown, there might be less contamination. So we have in the studio today Madeline, who has done surgery quite recently.
I'd just like to make a little disclaimer here. Last time I had to go into surgery, I managed to wash my hands and put on my gown and felt very proud. Arrived at the operating table and realised that I'd forgotten to put on any gloves. Oh. So I'm not necessarily the best person.
And also for anyone waiting for surgery, don't listen to that.
You'll all be pleased to hear I'm going to be a GP, not a surgeon.
But actually GPs do quite a lot of minor surgery. So what I'm doing now, I'm actually handing round gloves to all of the panel members here, because Madeline's going to show us the no-touch technique for putting your own gloves on, which is actually, you can't touch the outside.
This is definitely the blind leading the blind, but there we go.
But before we do that, I am actually going to see what happens. Oh yeah, with your gloves, turn the cuff up about an inch and a half. So before we do that, I'm actually going to see what happens when I try and gown up Madeline, and we're going to have a human panel detector to see whether or not any of my microbiome is going to touch the gown. So you guys are going to go beep every time I touch her. Okay. And Katie's going to take us through it.
Yes, so welcome. This is Katie speaking here. We are going to do the first live gown up ever on iScience Radio, I believe. So Madeline is at the ready. Hillary is a go. Madeline is miming washing her hands, which is what she would normally do. Oh, and she's scrubbing her nails as well to make sure. Oh, and ooh, now she's...
Oh, up to the elbow.
So she's going up to the elbow with the hand sanitizer and washing her hands, nails,
and up to all along her forearm. She's now smoothing them out by drying them, and she is ready. Hillary is poised, positioned. 3, 2, 1, let's go. So Madeline's arms are just being put into the dressing gown. Beep. That was a big beep there. So, and again. So as Madeline is putting her arms in, almost embracing Hillary, they have made contact several times. So the gown is now on Madeline, already a lot of microbiome on her. Hillary is wrapping herself around, bumping into chairs. It's all going haywire. Oh, goodness, that was a
That's a big beep.
Big beep, Hillary. Basically giving Madeline a hug there. She's tying up the sides. I mean, it's on. Madeline is dressed and ready.
Definitely not fit to practice. Now I'm going to talk through how we put on the gloves. So basically, we've got some sterile gloves in front of us. Yeah. You turn over the top of the glove because you mustn't touch the outside of the glove.
Okay.
You need to make sure they're the right size and your hands need to be completely dry, because otherwise you're going to end up with lots of your fingers in the same hole. Okay, then basically you need to pick up one glove with one hand. And then you need to place the other hand inside that glove, okay, without touching the hand. And then you need to slide your hand in and bring it all the way up. If you've touched any skin, you need to start again. Okay? Katie's had some trouble. Emily seems to be doing well.
I'm stuck here.
That's what happened with me.
And this is okay. So then you need to take the other one. Benedetta's still in the running. Take the other one. Pick it up on the underside.
On the underside.
Exactly. Okay. And then just squeeze your hand in.
I think I'll do a close up on.
And I've ended up with my little finger in my thumb hole, which is another reason why I'm not going to be a surgeon.
So, there we are.
Yay!
Excellent. Excellent. Sweet. Right, well, we have footage of that, how not to do it. Okay, so how do we think that experiment went? Yeah.
I think I'd make a bad surgeon.
Yeah, I think we've shown why the... Madeline, you were saying the current British technique is that surgeons gown themselves up.
We put on our own gowns and then someone else does up the cord round the middle. But what I thought was really interesting to point out with this study is that it didn't matter how experienced you were as a surgeon. So actually, some of the younger surgeons did better with the aseptic non-touch technique.
Why do you think that's the case?
Probably because it's been a short amount of time since they've been tested it in medical school. So the only time you ever given...
they don't assume that they know it.
Exactly. The only time you're ever examined on this is at medical school or when you start training. Mm. So it may just be that the older surgeons have got a bit rusty.
How dare you say that?
And how is the actual surgery room cleaned?
You know what? I have no idea. Very thoroughly, we'd all hope. outside of surgery hours, we never see it being cleaned ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you everyone for participating. And if you tried that at home, I'd really like you to.
Because, of course, everyone at home has some rubber gloves and a gown, surgery gown.
So the time now is 17:36. And we're going to move on to something which I find fascinating. This is, I found that last thing fascinating, but this is the future, I think. Emily, it's all about research into reading our minds.
Yes, so neuroscientists are teaching computers to turn brain activities into speech. So basically, there's been three different papers out recently with different research teams, and each has demonstrated that speech can be decoded from recordings of firing neurons in the brain. So in all the studies, electrodes were placed directly on the brain of patients, but it has to be during brain surgery, because the brain has to be kind of in contact with the electrodes, so don't worry, it can't happen while you're walking around.
Yet.
And patients either listened to speech or they read words out loud. And then computational models known as neural networks were used to reconstruct words and sentences using the neural data. So basically they kind of reconstructed the firing of the neurons. And it resulted in what was referred to as occasionally comprehensible phrases. So it didn't work all the time. But for one of the studies, patients heard numbers, and then when the computer spoke the numbers after, a group of listeners named them with 75% accuracy. And I think that we Shall have we, the clip.
Can we play it now?
Yeah, so as you can hear, it seems
like
a bit
very
creepy.
Bad recording, yeah. Yeah, recognizable.
But to think that a computer did that is pretty impressive. So do you think it's creepy? Yeah, it could be, but
potentially.
But luckily, there is a purpose for this. The researcher is saying that it will make it possible for people who lost the ability to speak. To speak again using a computer-to-brain interface. So instead of kind of using eye movements, which is kind of commonly used, it could be done a bit more accurately, yes. And they could have a bit more control over the tone and inflection and stuff.
Sorry to interject there, but I watched a programme called The Big Life Fix, and they tried to create these fixes for people that have problems, and there was this gentleman who had locked-in syndrome, and so he wasn't able to speak, and like you were saying, he was using the eye movement, but it sounded a very robotic voice.
Yeah.
So one of their fixes for him was they got all his old recordings that they had that they could find of him and cut out each word from each of the recordings or phrases that he would use, like I think his wife was called Zoe or something, and it was like, I love you, Zoe. And so, but it was his voice, so yeah. He could just, instead of doing the phrases in the robotic sounding voice, he could math it with his eyes again, which is different
technique.
That's
amazing,
and it would still sound like him.
Yeah.
So that's one way, but this seems to have advanced further than that even.
Yeah, I think it's also to help people kind of join in with conversations quickly, because a lot of the time it takes a long time for them to construct a sentence, whereas if it was using computational programs, it can be done pretty automatically.
But this is really potentially massive, that you can read people's thoughts. So people might know I'm really interested in transhumanism, and I was talking to my hairdresser. Nobody gets away from this course. What does he think about transhumanism? So I said, if you could have a special power, what would it be? And he said, I'd like to be able to read people's thoughts.
Yeah. Well, but that would be a horrible life, wouldn't it? Because, I'm sure everyone thinks things that nobody else wants to hear about, and you don't want others to think about, and it would be sort of societally destructive thing.
Have you guys not seen What Women Want?
Oh, yes.
Disaster.
I
asked him why, because I think like you, I just wouldn't want to know.
I don't think people should either.
Yeah, well, that's quite a strong ethical stance there from Katie. We'll come back to that. I love that. I love it. He said it was because he wanted to be ahead of the game. So a lot of these transhumanist things are about having a competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm. I suppose in law it could be used if you just read someone's mind to see if they did the crime. You could kind of get an insight into
Yeah,
but it can be used just in so many other horrible ways.
Definitely.
That is, I don't think the advantages that it actually gives is,
I would like to say that this wasn't reading minds. It was done to people listening to or producing speech, not imagining speech. So you don't have to worry about it just yet. But actually, one of the authors did say it may be possible in the future.
So this was that they could hear it.
Yeah, so they were listening to or talking, and then the electrodes on the brain, the neurons were firing, then the electrodes then kind of translated to a computer, which then kind of it identified a pattern and then kind of came up with its own speech back. So it wasn't just from the brain. It was from hearing sounds and then the brain through.
So it's not quite as bad as that. I did look up some research the things that people think about most often apparently are sex, food and sleep. And there is some research. There was that bogus research that suggested men think about sex every 7 seconds. It isn't actually as often as that.
It sounds tiresome.
It is actually
19 times a day men think. This was a study of male and female students. So men thought about it 19 times a day and women about 10 times a day. But they said that men also had thoughts about food and sleep.
And women didn't?
I know, I'm never surprised about that. So they were kind of just thinking about things that they wanted. quite a lot.
I definitely think about food at least 17 times a day.
Yeah. So.
17 times an hour. Yeah.
I mean, I think there is some problem with the research, because the way they did it was to go and say to people, click this button every time you think about sex, but try not to think about it more than you normally would be. I'm not thinking about it. I'm not thinking about it. I'm not thinking about food. I'm not thinking about how tired I am.
The famous white polar bear experiment.
Oh, is that one?
Yeah, so it's a psychology experiment. Basically, it's about intrusive thoughts. So they said to people, press basically that, try not to think about a white bear, but if you do, press the button. And then people who were told to not think about it obviously press it a lot, because you, by saying don't think about that, you're telling your brain to almost, you know,
you implant it.
I'm definitely now going to think about white bears at least 17 times a day.
Yeah, I think about them a lot after finding that out. It's like the game. Do any of you remember that?
I lost.
I just lost the game.
Who else lost?
So it's a thing, if you think about the game, then you've lost it. And then if you've lost it, you have to say it.
So you just thought about it. Yeah. I've lost.
Yeah,
lost.
You just lost the game.
I just lost.
You can never win it.
Yeah, because you can't think about not thinking about
it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, how clever.
A bit pointless, but.
Okay, so thank you for that. So we're going to move on now. Katie is going to talk about going vegan for January and maybe longer. But before we do that, let's have a song. We've got Animals by Maroon 5.
This is iScience Radio.
Yeah.
That was Maroon 5 Animals. Katie, tell us about your Veganuary.
Yes, so, I mean, maybe a little brief thing, a brief about thing about me. So I've been veggie vegan for the past 6-7 months, and I've decided that since everyone else is jumping on the Veganuary bandwagon, where you go vegan for the month of January or part of January and falling into February, that I would try and do it more rigorously.
Sorry, you were veggie vegan?
Veggie vegan. So I was vegetarian, but when I ate at home, I cooked for predominantly vegan meals.
Okay.
So people call themselves flexitarians, but I was kind of a flexi vegan.
Why not just vegetarian?
I was vegetarian, but I think it was more than that. I was putting more effort into okay. it than just okay. cutting out meat. I was actively not eating dairy.
She was on the fence.
I was on the fence.
So hang on, what are we all? I'm a pescatarian.
So you don't eat meat, but you eat fish?
I eat fish, but not with too many legs. So not
octopuses.
So my mum used to say she wouldn't eat things with eyelashes or fur.
Oh,
it was basically she was a polypescatarian. But people got very, very confused. So basically, she wouldn't eat mammals. But people then would debate.
Chickens.
So, yeah, they have very tiny eyelashes, but she didn't count them. So it got complicated.
Come with the magnifying glass. I'm vegetarian.
I'm vegan.
I'm a meat eater, but I'm trying to cut down on my meat consumption and
but
be more ethical.
But I don't think that we should. I personally don't think we should judge other people for their dietary choices, and so that's part of what I'm going to be talking about, a bit about Veganuary and what the messages really are. So reasons to try veganism, I thought we'd start off with, because people might just say, well, why are you going vegan? I'm like, well, here are a couple of options to choose from. So the first one is the obvious one about animals. That was the link with the Maroon 5 Animals song. So animals are able to perceive and feel and experience pain and happiness just as we do, and the production of food and clothing causes them to suffer in innumerable ways. And this is potentially a good chance to talk about different types of veganism. So we talked about clothing there. There's this idea that you can live a vegan lifestyle or a vegan diet or sort of a plant-based diet, and there are different avenues to which you can take depending on your beliefs and your reasons for becoming vegan. So personally, obviously I'm concerned about everything, but I'm just following a predominantly vegan diet, more along the plant-based
So you'd still have leather shoes?
So I do have them already, so I won't be purchasing any this month,
because you're doing the full experience.
And another reason to try veganism, which is predominantly why I begun a diet like this, was for health. So research shows that health is the second biggest reason people go vegan. So you can cut out the cholesterol, which lowers your blood pressure and helps to reduce the risk of diabetes and heart disease. I personally did it because I wanted to lose a bit of weight, so this was my kind of diet, because I thought, well, I'm cutting out dairy, which is probably my biggest weakness. And another one, which I think we're all fairly aware of at the moment, is the environment. So going vegan is the easiest and most effective way to help our planet, and it makes a more positive impact than giving up your car and can halve your greenhouse gas emissions. And then the final one is nutrition. So this is more leading into kind of the myths of becoming vegan. So getting the right nutrition is actually still easy when you're a vegan. You just need to know where to find it. And the Veganuary website also gives more information about doing so, because that is important that you do still do that. So leading into a couple of myths here that a couple of you might have had. So veganism is extreme. And this is what I was kind of trying to talk about earlier with people's perceptions of being a vegan. So there's this phrase that people say, so like, oh, how do you know someone's a vegan? Because they'll tell you. And I don't think that's specifically true. Like, it just so happens that when people meet up, they sometimes go for food. And then you have to say, oh, I'm vegan, can I have the vegan menu? So I think that, I mean, that would be my reason for why that might happen a bit more frequently than people would think. But yeah, veganism doesn't have to be extreme. You can go at your own pace. I think it's such a welcoming community. That even this idea of, you know, cutting down on meat-free Mondays. You know, people that do that, absolutely, like, you're making your part. Like, it shouldn't be an exclusive thing, it should be an inclusive thing. And I think that judging people for their dietary, so you're saying, oh, I eat meat, like, that's so bad. But, I mean, it's your choice. No one, I personally don't judge you for that. My housemate said when I first told her this, I said, just don't use my wok. I just don't want the meat juices in there. But the rest of it, absolutely go for it. She said, you don't mind me eating meat? And I said, personally, no, like, that's your choice, and I'm not going to judge you.
I have a thing about meat in the fridge. I really don't like meat in the fridge.
Oh, so we have separate fridges.
Yeah.
But that wasn't
really
my choice.
Well, it's dirty.
Surely it's better to have meat in the fridge than outside of the fridge, because then it's going to...
Or not at all, I think.
Correct.
Not at all would be right.
Just put it on the bottom shelf.
Yeah, but I think that the point is that, you know, each person will have their own individual views on it, but I think
I have a bit of a yuck thing, I think.
Uh-huh. I think again.
Yeah, I don't get this when people say, like, oh, a pretty steak. Like, there's no way any kind of meat looks pretty. Like, I'm sorry, but cooked steak or chicken,
even when I did eat meat, I didn't eat slabs of meat. It had to be some sort of form of processed meat before I would eat it, if that made sense. And so I didn't like the taste of meat, so that was another reason, personally, for me, why I...
Did anyone watch that documentary film, Nanook of the North? And they were... So this was about the Inuit people who only eat meat, just about, and a few roots.
That's because
and
that's the
that's
only thing they
That's all they can.
Have.
But they were eating raw seal.
Yeah.
And it was just... Oh, it was so gross. I couldn't cope with it. I mean, I was thinking, fine, they have to live. That's really important. And then when they took the blubber, and apparently they use the blubber like we use butter, so a bit of raw meat with a bit of blubber. And they seem to be enjoying it, sorry. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm just having a yuck moment.
I thought that as well when I was watching it. I thought, this is weird. But then I'm like, but that's their lifestyle.
That
like
is their
said,
lifetime. I was trying not to judge, like, but I was just having a physical reaction.
For us to evolve to where we are now, to have this choice of becoming vegan, we had to, you know, live through stuff like that. So that's why I think inclusive community.
Yeah.
Another couple of myths. Vegan food is boring. I think personally it's done the opposite for me. So going to a restaurant where there may only be like one or two vegan options has forced me to be a bit more experimental and try new things. And actually it's far from boring, in my opinion. And then another thing about the vegans lack important nutrients. There are lots of ways for you to gain them from other sources. So they actually, Veganuary, send out a little checklist for you to do. Called the Daily Dozen, and that helps you keep track of your nutrients and which ones you're getting. For example,
that's
beans, berries, other fruits, cruciferous vegetables, greens, other vegetables, flax seeds, nuts and seeds, spices, whole grains, drinks and exercise. So that's kind of their Daily Dozen idea of what you should be trying to achieve for in a perfect world. But even if you were eating meat, you might not achieve all of them as well. But this is just a nice way if you are concerned about the nutrition aspect of turning vegan, then this is a nice way that they can help you. Another one is vegan food is too expensive. I can't remember, I think myself and Emily were having a discussion about this earlier. Actually, some vegan foods that you get are even cheaper than meats.
Yeah.
For example, the meat substitutes like corn or Linda McCartney vegetarian sausages.
I find this really strange when people assume that if you're a vegetarian that you want to eat meat, so that's why you look for like a substitute. Like, I don't need a substitute. Like,
I think it's
not like I'm missing meat.
No, but I think sometimes for some meals, for example, I like to cook a vegan chili. It's sometimes nice to have something in there that is not necessarily tastes like meat, but is meats
like
in
the main
substance.
Yeah.
And there are some things like bacon which are just so delicious. So that cheating bacon, have you tried that one? It's a soya based one, and it's even got the now having done my bit about how the yuck and how I didn't like it, but something about it has the white of the rind, and then it has kind of, it's pink, and you fry it and it smells like bacon and it tastes like bacon, and it's lovely.
I mean, go for it.
It's vegan as well.
Yeah.
You do you.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
And then another one is vegan food is complicated. I think that it's become less so, especially with its introduction into supermarkets in the form of there's a lot more processed vegan food. Okay, that might not be why you're going down that route, but if you're looking for something to do quickly, there is a lot out there in the supermarkets now. And I got a couple of recipe books for Christmas, so I had So Vegan in 5, so that's 5 ingredients, and another one called 50 Minute Vegan, where you cook meals in 50 minutes or under, which I thought would be quite easy and help me do Veganuary. So you can still sign up for Veganuary now. As of 3 days ago, there were 250,000 sign-ups from 193 countries. accessories. Mm-hmm. So I'm on my second day because I only started yesterday because I just got back to uni and getting in the swing of things again. So I have 31 days of emails with lots of information on vegan food essentials, accidentally vegan food, such as Oreos, the Daily Dozen, which is what I spoke about.
I'm sold.
Plans, cookbooks, the lot. And there are great Instagram accounts out there as well, which I would recommend people to follow if that's your thing, such as Accidentally Vegan UK, The Little London Vegan, We Are Veganuary, and Fat Gay Vegan, which are all great ones. I think my challenge this Veganuary will be eating out. I go to a different country. It's my birthday. Weaknesses might come, but I will triumph.
Oh, that sounds absolutely amazing. Is anyone else going to give it a go?
I've been vegetarian for far too long. I just can't be bothered, to be honest, to be vegan as well. So.
Just try it for a month, you know?
I don't want to be honest. I don't see the kind of point. Like, I'm sorry. With all this convincing, I'll keep to my vegetarian.
The point wasn't to be convincing. It was to just introduce a new diet.
No, totally. Try people. Yeah. I'll stick much to
mine. I'm tempted. I am actually tempted because when I started here last year, I went on Fresher's Fair and they had, it was a virtual reality of a cow and what happened to the cow when it was being slaughtered and its milk. Anyway, look, we can't put off the end of the show for any longer. That's just about all we've got time for today. Thank you so much to our panellists. That was a really good, fun programme. And we'll be back next week. We're going to have a guest producer, Rachel. Rachel on her own next week. Hey! So join us then right here on IC Radio, Monday 5 p.m.
iScience Radio, online at iSciencemag.co.uk. Follow us on Twitter @iSciencemedia.